Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest on this episode, Elmar Gusenseid, said, "Every one of these roles throughout my career on the civilian side gave me a certain experience I needed to pursue my journey to run a business." Growing up in the suburbs outside St. Paul, Elmar knew early on he wanted to serve in the military. The events of 9/11 at the beginning of his college years nearly shook him off this path, but he stayed the course and finished his undergraduate degree in international business. During his Army career, he deployed twice, once to Baghdad in 2007 during the height of the surge, and a second time, 11 years later, to Central Europe in a civil affairs capacity. Elmar continues to serve in the Army today, transitioning to the reserves in 2009, where he's coming up on 19 years of service. Today, Elmar is on a very intentional path towards gathering the skills necessary to manage a business at the corporate level. From an early yogurt plant manager position at General Mills to his current role at Cargill in acetylene production, Elmar's experiences across agriculture can serve as a roadmap for those interested in pursuing a similar career. Have a listen as his military time continues to serve him in his current role and some fascinating details about citric acid production.
I grew up in the city, so I was kind of a city boy. I didn't have a lot of agriculture background and just kind of grew up and then in the States. Spend most of my time in the suburbs. So didn't really know what I was doing, getting ready for college. But one thing, early in my teenage year, I kind of realized that I definitely wanted to go in the military and just had that drive. Just wasn't sure how that was going to turn out.
For some people, that drive for the military comes from some familial service or something like that. I mean, where did that originate for you?
You know, it's just something that, you know, I read a lot. So, you know, reading books and from history, certain wars, but really as I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do in life, I was really wanting to serve others, but I also wanted to be challenged physically and mentally. I didn't feel like I was getting that challenge. And just military just checks all the block for me when I start thinking about, okay, I'm going to go and do great and wonderful things and help serve others. But at the same time, you know, get the most out of myself, both from a physical and mental standpoint.
You mentioned growing up in the suburbs. What state, what city?
Just outside of St. Paul in Minnesota.
Okay. I mean, just like there's lots of flavors of ice cream at Baskin Robbins, there's lots of different services that you can go into here.
Yeah.
I mean, which one did you sort of orient towards and why?
You know, for whatever reason, I had my sights set on the Army. I knew I wanted to be an infantryman. I wanted to become an airborne range qualified and really wanted to become one of the leaders and wanted to go to combat and always had that. I was never really a strong swimmer, so the Navy was always out of the question for me. But that's really why I wanted to go to the Army. And so I realized, like, coming out of high school, you know, there's various steps I could have taken to accomplish that. But I finally decided to join Army ROTC and Minnesota State University in Mankato. And that happened to be the same month that 9/11 happened. So September of 2001 is actually when I signed my Army ROTC scholarship.
Was that most people where they were, what they were doing when that happened? What are your memories of that day?
Well, my memories are pretty clear. We're sitting in the dorm room early in the morning, getting ready for class and seeing the first plane hit the tower, and that was a big shock. And then as I was making my way downstairs, we had kind of the common hall downstairs, and that's when I saw the second plane. And you know, it was interesting because at the time, you know, you kind of realize that things are about to go south, right? Things are going to escalate. And then as a freshman in college with less than a month in college, I have to make a decision for myself. So do I just say, forget it and just enlist and get, you know, be part of whatever's about to happen, or, you know, just let things kind of play out, do what I'm supposed to do, you know, finish college, go through the program. Ultimately, the latter one I decided to go with and just be a little bit more patient in terms of there will be time and there will be a chance for me to go and do what I need to do after that happened.
Yeah, that decision point around, do I interrupt my current plan and go fight for lack of a better word there, but for me was in 2003, right during the early invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. I can remember being in high school and saying, man, I'm on track to go through the ROTC program at A&M and join the Marines as an officer. But man, do I want to stop what I'm doing now and go change course? And there were two really influential people in my life that said, stay the course, right? I had a master sergeant who was in charge of the ROTC program in high school that I was in. And then of course my family. So for you, I'm wondering who was that sort of heavy hand, if you will, that said, stay the course.
You know, I don't know if I really had a heavy hand. I had similar experiences with, you know, the ROTC instructors that were like, hey, yeah, I understand what you're trying to do. We don't even know what's going to happen, right? I mean, this is early in September. We didn't know what the response was. Obviously, on the soft side, things were happening already. But and that was kind of the thing, like, stay the course. You have a good plan. You have a scholarship right now. Finish what you're doing. And then you will always have the opportunity to do what you want to do. And that's really the same kind of thing that was in my mind is, but just stick to the plan, finish. And be patient, your time will come.
Hindsight being always what it is 2020, was that the right call?
I think so. I mean, how my career shaped up and some of the experience I gained, you know, post graduating from Arts Again Commission, my deployments, and just everything that worked out, right? Everything happens for a reason, God has a plan, and I think that was the right thing.
Did you go down the route that you wanted to go down with infantry and airborne? What were some of those early career steps like for you in the Army?
Yeah, it did. I accomplished what I wanted to do. I don't know what I wanted to do at the time. I just knew like, hey, the first 4 or 5 years, right after I get my scholarship, this is what my journey is going to look like. What it's going to look like after that, I didn't know, right? I got married, I have kids, right? That influenced a lot of my decisions going forward. And so I did what I had to do. Obviously, I deployed and did what I went in the Army to do and serving combat and lead soldiers. There was a point in my career where I was like, you know, I think it's time for me to transition to civilian life, but continue my service, right? And that's why I continue, you know, coming up 19 years now, you know, still doing what I'm doing, just not a full-time basis.
Right. And just for the listeners that maybe are unfamiliar with that, as a reservist, correct?
Yep, as a reservist. Yeah.
Okay. Give us just a quick overview, if you would. I know it doesn't always feel like it at the time, but of some of those early deployments, where'd you go?
Sure.
What would you do just so that we can kind of frame that out?
Yeah. So I've deployed a couple times, right? So the first one is we talked about 15 months active duty to Iraq. I was part of the famous surge back in 2007. And then my second deployment was as a battalion commander now in the Army Reserve for Civil Affairs units in support of Operation Atlantic Resolve, which was focused on kind of enhancing NATO's defense capabilities, maintaining that presence in Central Eastern Europe, leading up to some of the recent events in Europe. And so those two experiences were completely different, right? So the first one is kind of the gung-ho combat deployment, I had the privilege of leading a scout and sniper platoon, focusing on putting down sectarian violence, improving security in one of, I would say, most dangerous neighborhoods at the time in Baghdad. While the second one, you know, now I'm obviously a little higher in rank as a battalion commander, but still leading small civil affairs teams across a broad range of across Europe. And that was really focused on that NATO-US collaboration of civil military activities, helping kind of enhance those host nation government response plans, civilian resistance preparedness as they were getting ready to face some hybrid and other threats. So if I was going to put that in kind of the doctrinal army terms, right, in the phases of military operation, I went from phase three, which is dominate, to more like phase zero, where we kind of shaped the environment. But they were both very, I learned quite a bit from both of them.
I always like to ask when I see it about memorial bracelets that folks wear. And I notice you've got one on. To the extent that you're comfortable talking about it, would love to hear a little bit about that story.
Yeah, so William Crow is a staff sergeant, was one that I'm wearing. And I remember, as a matter of fact, an anniversary came up here recently on June 28th. So William was one of my squad leaders as we were preparing for this combat deployment into Iraq. And he was a great guy. And he was already on his third deployment. He's done so much and had five children. You know, right before the deployment, unfortunately, you know, I got moved to executive officer to help kind of with the logistics and getting everybody over before I took over the scout. But, you know, we continue our relationships. We continue to talk even down range. And unfortunately, you know, in June of 2007, his truck, his Humvee was hit with EFP. In Iraq and just on the outskirts of Baghdad and a lot of folks in his truck were badly injured, but William lost his life and I kind of was very close with him and really hit home for me and I continue to remember him and continue to remember his family.
In those kinds of situations, it's always telling of the folks that surround it, him and the leadership as to, you know, how they respond to something like that. So you had already moved up to the XO role prior to that, but whoever his platoon commander was, I mean, to the extent that you know how, what was the sort of response to that situation with him on the ground?
Yeah. I mean, everybody supports each other, right? Getting those guys back to number one priority was getting everybody back to the foreign operating base that we're at, get them out to making sure they receive proper care, evac those that needed to go for a higher level response and more surgical capabilities that we didn't have. But really sticking together, right? And every unit has those times where things kind of go south and supporting each other, whether I was any platoon leader there or not, knowing what that team is going through, that platoon leader, platoon sergeant, obviously I had a great relationship with that platoon sergeant still from my time there and just supporting each other to this time. And of course, you know, going after those who did that.
What was the time difference between when that 15-month deployment ended and went on the civil affairs deployment to what sounds like all of Europe?
Yeah, it was, 11 years. So it was 11-year right. difference between those two, and definitely a lot different from experience levels that I've had.
So 2018 time frame or so?
19, yeah.
19, yeah. Okay. And can you share, because I've never interacted with anybody that has had that sort of deployment. So I would love a story, perhaps, if you had one, or a good or bad thing that happened during a deployment like that, where you've got a lesson learned with you that still hangs on today?
I think one of the majority of the lessons learned from a leadership standpoint would probably be your combat deployments, right? Versus kind of more like the phase zero type. And I think, as we look back to the end of our 15-month deployment, the big lesson learned that I really took away for the rest of my career and probably helped me in my next deployment now as a battalion commander versus a platoon leader. Is really thinking about those last 2 weeks, right? And so the surge was, you can argue, working and not working, but the last 2 weeks were probably some of the toughest times that we've had as things were getting really rough in our part of Baghdad. Iraqi forces were basically being overrun by a surge, and a lot of them were just taking their uniforms and abandoning the checkpoints. And then, here we are. Now we have to go and save them. And then, like I said, we're on the 15-month deployment that was supposed to be 12 months, right? That's what they told us, at least when we left. At this point in our deployment, we're supposed to be packing up to go home, conducting some relief in place mission with the following unit. But really, we should be kind of sitting back and getting ready to come home now. Instead, here we are finding ourselves in the midst of intense combat, fighting insurgents, protecting Iraqi forces. And you could only imagine what the morale of all the soldiers was at the time, right? They're obviously upset, they're mad. And this is really where you learn that lesson as a leader, right? To be more resilient, to set the standard, to show adaptability and positiveness, but at the same time focusing on mission accomplishment. And really for me at the time is I just wanted to bring every one of my men home, given we're so close to it. And so I kind of took that lesson because even in civilian career, even in being in Europe, there are always times where things are just tough. And everyone looks at you as a leader. How are you going to react, right? And that's going to set the tone for everybody else. And so that lesson really helped me kind of set my the stage in my career and making sure I'm the positive example as I'm leading others through tougher times and showing that resiliency.
At what point did you leave the active duty service and start to pursue life in the civilian sector? And what was the rationale behind that sort of primary transition from active to reserve?
So I left active duty later in 2009. So, came back from Iraq and went back to Fort Benning. And really at the time, already on my third child, I kind of decided, I wanted to pursue a civilian career, right? I already had a degree in international business. And so I kind of knew that, the next steps for me will be, working somewhere at a Fortune 500 company. Didn't know how that's going to happen, but that was kind of where I kind of set my sights on. But at the same time, like I was so into the military and I knew that I didn't want to let go of the camaraderie and the people and the brotherhood that we had. I wanted to stay in one capacity or another. And this is where, I made a decision that, yes, I'm not going to be on active duty anymore. I'm going to pursue a different career that I went to college for, I got a degree for. But at the same time, I don't want to completely walk away from something that been maybe my childhood dream. And so I want to continue to serve just a more of a part-time reserve capacity.
How did you start to narrow down which of these Fortune 500 companies you wanted to work with such a broad degree like international business?
Well, it was challenging. I'm not going to lie. And I think a lot of veterans are finding this, right? Even in today's environment, that it's hard to find. So I say I probably got lucky. And the reason I say that, so I came across a junior military officer recruitment agency called Cameron Brooks. And they really came in
Oh,
and
yeah.
they helped me with my transition. They kind of walked me through the process, right? They put me through this development and preparation program known as Mini MBA. They invited me to like an exclusive career conference where a lot of these companies were coming in, and I had the opportunity to interview for various roles. And then once that was done, they actually helped me through every step, right? From the follow-on interviews to offer acceptance. And so I think that was just, without that, I don't know what I would do, to be honest with you. So that was really critical for my transition as I was leaving the military and going to a corporate environment.
From there, right, early 2009, maybe into 2010, Georgia Pacific, Eaton, Ecolabs. I mean, these are all big companies prior to settling on where you are now at Cargill. What were those experiences like?
So when I left these conferences, right, with Cameron Brooks, I was fortunate enough that I had like a few offers, right? And then ultimately I decided to go with the General Mills. That was my first post-military experience as an operations team leader at the yogurt plant, because now I was able to kind of apply those same leadership skills that I acquired in the Army in a business environment, but in the same time, learn how to run a plant, right? And so through my time, you know, obviously I've learned a lot in General Mills. These other organizations that you mentioned were kind of part of a very intentional career change that I've made, right? Mm. And the reason I say it's intentional, because every one of these roles throughout my career on the civilian side, and I would even say the same in the military side, gave me a certain experience, right, that I pursued in my journey to run a business. And so, for example, right, it helped me learn how to run a larger department in the manufacturing environment, or leading a unionized workforce, or driving continuous improvement across multiple sites, working on solutions to solve certain customer problems. I got to manage budgets, and I got to manage P&Ls. I got to develop strategies and execute strategies that others develop, right? So it almost like a journey, right? A lifelong journey, but with a bunch of check marks that I had to go through and get those experiences. That's why it was intentional. It wasn't obviously going like this, a lot of zigzagging going on, but that's really why I pursued those roles. And that's how I ended up here.
There's a lot of forethought in that, that isn't necessarily common. And so I'm curious as to how that would work out practically speaking. So let's take General Mills as an example, right? As a plant facility manager, first career out. At some point, did you realize in order to progress, I need skills A, B, and C? So let me start to look for an opportunity at Georgia Pacific, for example, that offers experience in skills A, B, and C, and then step forward from there. Is that even close to how that intentional progression would work or work for you?
I think kind of, right? So when you think about like, okay, so I started this role, right? And I'm gaining the experience that I want to get. But there's also like these certain things I need to gain, because at the end of the day, I have an end game. I think it all comes down to what is your end game, right? And when I went into the corporate side, I said, hey, my end game is going to run a business, but I'm going to need to check certain blocks. I need to learn certain things, right? And then when you identify those things that you need to, those skill sets that you need to get, or those experiences you need to get in your next role, and then just when the opportunity comes, and again, that's where, and we can talk a little bit more about networking, but that's when the networking becomes important and those types of things, when an opportunity comes in, and then you can kind of match that opportunity to those skill set experience you're looking to get to reach your end game, that's really where those moves come in, right? So I've been in some roles for 3 years. I've been in some roles for 18 months, right? It really depends when you're ready, but also when that opportunity exists for you to go and pursue those experiences and get those skill sets that you're looking for your end game.
Your audio broke up just for a second there when you, and that's important to highlight, when you said your end game is to what? Gather skills necessary to run your own business? I only caught the beginning and the end of that. What was the end?
Yeah. It's just to run a business, right? So to be a VP GM in the corporate world, right? And okay. So as the VP GM, there's not a certain path to it, but there's certain things that you kind of got to know and the experience and work in, whether, you know, you manage in a unionized workforce, for example, versus non-unionized workforce, because those are two different animals, right? There are different rules and things like that, right? Managing the front end of the business when, you know, marketing, sales, having a direct impact with the customers, but then also understanding and being somewhat an expert on the back end of the business and the operation. How do you make the product? How do you bring your product to market, right? From an engineer standpoint, what's the supply chain look like? So really having that broad scope of all the different functions and all the different experiences and leadership levels is kind of what, you know, I'm striving for.
Okay. And just again, for acronym and audience sake, VPGM, Vice President of General Management?
Vice President, General Manager, right.
General yep. Manager. Okay. Yep. And so a perception of something like spending 18 months here, 3 years there, right? Sort of jumping around to different careers. A perception could be that there's a search for something, right? So how to manage as you through this really intentional on your end, how did you manage that was perceived by folks who looked at a resume and would say, maybe three jobs in 6 years, like, you know, how did you manage that perception?
Well, I think if you look at it holistically, it's not really a job difference, right? A lot of times you see something going up, maybe going lateral, right, into a different function. So, you know, it's never really been where, like, you have exact same job and you go from point one company to another, right? That's really what jumping is, when you just do the same exact thing going from one place to another. But when you do focus on different skill sets, different function, when you go up, that's really where things are becoming a little bit different. And it's not really at that point a job hopping per se, because then you can explain that why you're going after a certain role.
Yeah, that's fair. There sounds like there's a fair amount of just shaping in the way that is communicated or presented that's important, that shows progression and not just lateral transfer.
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned a point about networking, and I want to bring it back up here. There's a couple schools of thought, right, on how or when networking should occur. Like, should you build it all at the beginning of your transition or on your way out of the military, such that you have that network established when you move out? Or is this something that you slowly build as you move through an intentional career progression process? What's your take on that?
I think it's a continuous process. There's never too early to start networking. I started networking, you know, obviously when I was still in active duty. That's how I found out about Cameron Brooks and everything else, right? And I think today, with LinkedIn, which didn't exist at the time, and all these other tools, there's even easier ways to network, right? And that is really what's driving kind of a lot of the success from what I've seen from transitioning veterans today, is their ability to network and learn from others. To me, it's obviously you want to network with other veterans. That's one, but then you also want to network with recruiters, HR professionals, right? Tell your story about, hey, here's who I am, here's how I got here. And that's really important. And I really took that lesson right from the get-go and continued to build a network. And then networks is also an important piece. It's not about what somebody can do for you, but also it's a two-way street, right? Mm-hmm. Also bring value to that too, right? So it's important, because if you're only reaching out for help but never offering help, that's not a network. It's always important to understand the context of what network means. Is a two-way street. It's a relationship that you have to invest right. in and put time and effort into it. And that's really what I've been preaching to, you know, some of the guys that I've been talking to that are transitioning to the military. It's important to build it, but it's also important to invest in it.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? To build versus invest implies a give and take. And I think that often the outreach is to bring that individual or group into your network, but rather there's not much thought really given to what can I provide or invest into this relationship before I even make the outreach. So that's a great point. I'm glad that you brought that up. Cargill.
Yeah.
Now we're here, right? How did you get from this intentionally progressive career that allowed you to build a capability set to this opportunity that you're now sitting at Cargill?
Yeah. So again, this is another byproduct of networking, right? As I mentioned, and through, you know, I've been living in Twin Cities, is probably the longest time I've lived since I kind of went in the military for a good 8-9 years. And then, so that allowed me to build kind of that network within the Twin City area. Obviously that's the home of Cargill, and through that network, meet a lot of folks that work for Cargill, veterans or non-veterans alike. And the same time, as you kind of go through, you help me learn about the culture and the purpose, which to me aligned with my drive to continue to serve, right? So this is really, you know, going back to the ag piece, this is my first real exposure to ag besides working for General Mills. And so as I kind of went through it, you know, this role came up, I had the opportunity to interview for this role, and just was tremendously impressed with everyone that I was engaged during that process. And again, it was aligned with my career journey and the next steps to make sure that my next role was in that general management capacity. And that's where kind of ended up. And then I've been with Cargill ever since.
So just quick, great shout out to Jason Burley, because I think we both have crossed paths with that wonderful human being in the past. Remind me how you originally got introduced to him, or how you knew, how you guys interacted.
Well, Jason and I connected again through a network and LinkedIn and everything else. Jason also does a lot for the community, for the veteran community here in the Twin Cities. A very, very active person. And of course, when I came in to Cargill, I actually started them. I made sure to intentionally come in and let him know that I'm here with Cargill and spend some time with him in person. So, but yeah, he is a great advocate. Also spent a lot of time in the Army National Guard himself. But yeah, definitely. And again, that's just the great network we have here, veterans like Jason was, that continues to grow. And really, when folks go into organizations, right, I always recommend just find other veterans, right? There is a community that exists, small or big, but it does exist, and just find it and be part of it.
Describe for listeners what exactly you do at Cargill right now.
So I'm in a role of a Sigilance product line manager, and so and then I'm part of the Cargill's food and bio business, and so I get the opportunity to lead a cross-functional team that's really focused on serving our customers across various food, beverage, and industrial space. And so Sigilance is the product we make is a citric acid. It's really an essential ingredient, and it's an important additive to that food and beverage as well as industrial industry. In this role, I'm, you know, this role allows me to focus on driving business results, and at the same time, creating long-term strategy, again, focused on customer experience, focused on innovation, and in the umbrella of the plant-based ingredient space.
Okay, let's pause there, right? So I'm not familiar really at all with a Sigilance. So what do you mean that it's a plant-based ingredient?
Yeah. So this ingredient, a citric acid-based product, right? It's really made out of from fermentation technology. So that's a biotechnology that uses microorganisms to change from a cornstarch into citric acid, right? So we go and source corn, right? And we make multiple ingredients for food and beverage supply out of corn. And then citric acid just is one of those ingredients that we make through this biotechnology process.
Does it require a particular varietal of corn to make this particular product? Or is it a byproduct, if you will, of another process?
So it's basically you take a bushel of corn and then put it through kind of the fermentation process, which kind of is more of a like a that looks at the microorganisms and works through the technology piece of this. And then that's how it grows just like a bug, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a biological mm-hmm. process and grows a bug using that as kind of the corn starch as the main ingredient, and then creates the citric acid through that process.
Listening to you talk about working across domains, tech, manufacturing, marketing, customer development. I mean, certainly coming out of the Army, right? Even in with civil affairs type degree and international business, right? You're not going to know how citric acid and acetylates are produced. How does somebody that wants to be where you are, how do they prepare for not having any experience in some of these areas, but ultimately wanting to go to a place like Cargill and do some of the things that you're describing?
You know, I always do the feedback going back to, like, you know, becoming a platoon leader, right? In the Army, fresh lieutenant coming out of college, you don't know two things about the Army. And then they give you a 40-person platoon and, like, go lead it. You can't lead it because you don't really know what you're doing. And that's really where it's important to ask questions, to listen, to learn, continue to invest in development, right? Making sure you have the right experts at your disposal that you can build a relationship with. And that's really what, you know, I've always done in my career. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Coming before Cargill, I didn't even know what citric acid was, right? I didn't know how fermentation process work. And if you look at my career, I've worked in so many different segments, you know, from food manufacturing to chemical manufacturing to hydraulics, and now, you know, in this biotechnology space. And so it's really up to that individual, right, to learn and ask the question, spend time, right? I've had the opportunity to spend a lot of time on our manufacturing floor to understand how is this product produced, what are the challenges, where are the opportunities, and then at the same time, go back and on the front end side of the business, understand how do the customers use it? What are their issues? What are they trying to solve? How do the consumers consume that? It's funny because, you know, I find myself grocery shopping with my wife and I'd be looking at the ingredients like, oh, does this have citric acid? I've never done that, right? But it's actually pretty cool. I don't know if she enjoys that as much as I do, but it's cool. And you pick up, you know, something and you say, well, Cargill, this is Cargill product. This is Cargill product. This is Cargill product. And this is exciting because it really tells you how important this role is and how important the ag industry is to securing that food supply chain.
Look, Elmar, I really appreciate your time. I'll give you the last word. Is there anything that I'm not asking you or that we haven't talked about that we should have?
Yeah, I think just going back and really thank you for having this podcast, because I think it's important, you know, to highlight, you know, why veterans should be in the ag space, right? What is important is that I think about, you know, myself and how I ended up here and some of these other folks that are coming out of the military, right? When we leave the military, we look for an industry, an organization that has similar values, right? And gives you the purpose to serve, leveraging, you know, those unique skills, experience, and abilities that we gain out of our service in the military. And obviously, you know, now being in it, the industry that stands out as a promising and kind of the fulfilling path for veterans is agriculture. I'm really proud to be part of it today. And I also get that when I come to Cargill, right? The Cargill focus on nourishing world with a safe, responsible, sustainable way, but also allows myself and other veterans as part of our veteran military support network to kind of work together in this network and you know, develop talent, foster career growth together, and then create that purpose within our community. In our organization. So that is also important. So it's two things, right? One is just finding fulfilling career base in the industry that passionate about, that can share the same values. And then the secondly is finding that niche and finding that network of other veterans who are willing to kind of work together and build a camaraderie and help each other to that career journey. So those are the things I would leave you with today.
What struck me most about this conversation with Elmar was the intentionality through which he's progressed during his career. He started with an end goal of being a VP general manager in the corporate world, and every step he's taken since leaving college has been towards gathering the skills necessary to achieve those goals. As someone who loves ag, I hope we can continue to benefit from his experience as he pursues this path, but I'm also a firm believer that this determination and forethought was a direct result of his military service. I also think that his progression across industries can be an example for those other veterans on how to thoughtfully navigate different careers and avoid the stigma of career hopping. Have an end goal in mind and constantly have your head on a swivel for opportunities that present themselves that allow you to gather the skills necessary to progress to the next level of complexity. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and until next time, stay frosty.